Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about how we talk to people who are different from ourselves. In this episode, you're going to hear a conversation with David Goodhart. David is a journalist, commentator, and author. He's a former correspondent for the Financial Times. He founded Prospect magazine and edited it, and he still writes frequently for the broadsheets. He's also a former director of centre-left think tank Demos, and is now head of demography, immigration and integration at centre-right think tank Policy Exchange. He's become known in recent years for his thinking on immigration. His book, The British Dream, and more recently, The Road to Somewhere, both wrestle with questions of nationhood, identity, and how we manage the movement of people. We spoke about the deep value difference between those who feel rooted to place and those who don't, his own transition between political tribes, and whether the gap left by religion's retreat can or should be filled. David, thank you so much for being willing to speak to me today. I'd love to hear your answer to the question that I'm asking everyone. What are your sacred values? What do you hold sacred?
Right. That is a very big and difficult question, particularly at a time when we're not really used to talking about the sacred. It's not a word I ever really use. I'm not a very religious person, and it's a word that we've come to associate very much with religion. There are obviously sort of things in my life that are sacred to me, my home, my children. They're now grown up, actually, and I'm also divorced, so home and children are not actually any longer the same things, but obviously they overlap in meaning. I would say, moderately nationalistic. I'm a big sports fan, so I care a lot about when England are being badly beaten by Australia in the cricket.
Is there a defining value or a principle that you feel has shaped your life, or you've tried to let your life be shaped by, even if you haven't always lived up to it?
I'm not sure there really is, to be honest. I mean, you know, we all want to be good, but that doesn't really take us very far, because we then have to define what we mean by it. We want to, we want to have a reputation for being good and moral and decent and upstanding. And I think we want our future self to be an improvement on our past self. I think I do have that sense of wanting to try to learn by mistakes and be a better person. I'm not sure I am necessarily. To become a more aware person, both self-aware and also particularly in my line of business, which is kind of analysing and writing about current society, to be a better and truer analyst of our situation.
So intellectual honesty, maybe.
Yes. Exactly. You know, admitting one's mistakes, being open to making mistakes, both personal and intellectual, and learning from them and revising one's outlook as a result.
Well, I'm sure we'll come back to that, but I want to let our listeners hear a little bit more about you, understand you a bit better. So perhaps you could tell me a bit about what were the spiritual or perhaps philosophical background to your childhood. Were there any values that were really formative in your childhood?
Again, nothing particularly stands out, I have to admit. I was brought up in an Anglican household. My parents were affluent, upper middle class. My father, both my parents were half American, so there was a kind of American influence in the background. You know, we had peanut butter before it was common in this country.
Did that make you very cool at school?
No. And my father's father was Jewish, but I wasn't particularly aware of that when I was young. It was not something that my father particularly talked about. He was himself a politician. Soon after I was born, he became a Conservative MP in 1957, and was a very absent father. I had a kind of old-fashioned traditional upper-class upbringing, in that I went away to boarding school when I was young, when I was not quite 8 years old. So didn't have a very close relationship with either of my parents. I was also unusually one of a very large family. I have six siblings. I'm one of seven. And that probably had the greatest, that was probably the greatest single influence on me. I think there's a lot to be said for large families. I have four children of my own, which never seemed particularly many to me coming from one of seven, but most other people say, wow, four. Yeah.
I just had my second, so four sounds heroic to me.
Right. So there was always a comfortable sense of having lots of people around, not really being allowed to be too much of a loner, although then being sort of removed from that and going off to a boarding school, you know, when you're still a very young person, obviously leaves its mark. In terms of the religion, I did go to church as a small child. Neither of my parents were particularly religious. It was very much sort of going through the motions. There was obviously an Anglican background, both at my prep school and then public school. And I think, you know, you unconsciously imbibe some of the imagery and, of course, the language. And you know, I mean, having not really been to church for, apart from Christmas Day occasionally, I'm not quite sure what the occasion was, but I suddenly realised I knew all the words of the Lord's Prayer still. I mean, not terribly impressive, but that, you know, some of that had gone into my deep memory a long time ago, and rather wonderful words they are too. I never felt any great spirituality or any great commitment to... I was confirmed, I think... By the time I was confirmed into the church, I'd already lost any faith I had. I was doing it simply to please my parents and indeed godparents, but it didn't really mean anything to me. And I, you know, this was in the kind of, when are we, sort of early 1970s, and I was, you know, as typical sort of rather kind of hippie-ish young man who didn't believe in any of that old stuff any longer.
What would you call yourself now? Culturally Christian, agnostic, atheist?
I've certainly, you know, I mean, having been, you know, quite a long way out on the liberal spectrum, I'm certainly much more small c conservative about things. So I'm much more appreciative of the value of religion, even if I'm not particularly, you know, I haven't reconnected with it in my own life. I think I would probably still call myself an agnostic, but much more interested in religion, and indeed what the meaning of losing our religion as a society has for us, and whether it does indeed lie behind many of our social problems, and if so, how can we either revive it or produce something that plays the same function as religion in our lives. I mean, I think there is a sort of religion-shaped hole in Western liberal societies, or particularly European ones. It's not quite so true in the United States. And I think it's something that I think people will talk about more. I mean, it's possible, perhaps partly in response to the kind of re-religionizing of our society through immigration. I mean, we are actually becoming more religious societies, just not amongst the ethnic majority. The ethnic majority continues to lose its religion, while the growing minorities, African, South Asian, are overwhelmingly religious, often... You know, and it's often a very, very central aspect of their lives. And there hasn't been, I'm not sure whether there has been perhaps a little bit in America, but there hasn't been a sort of competitive re-religionizing of the ethnic majority, which you might have expected, or not yet anyway.
There is a movement known as reverse missionaries, which gets covered occasionally in the Christian press, where particularly British Commonwealth countries feel an obligation to send missionaries back to the mother country in right. order to bring the gospel that they themselves received. Right. I'm not sure how successful they're being, right. But it is something that is present. Obviously, one of the things we think about at Theos is this idea that we believe religion in general, Christianity in particular, has a huge amount to offer to wider society, has some wisdom, some thinking, and some people power, social capital, commitment, motivation for the common good, that it does significantly more harm, and it does significantly more good than it does harm, in contrast to kind of the public narrative of it. But obviously there's some ways in which certainly within our public language religious people haven't always been as helpful as they might have been. So as someone who is not one of religion's cultured despisers, but wouldn't call yourself religious, what would be some advice you might give for people of faith, how they can better serve their communities and perhaps stop shutting down their own space by perhaps being a bit tin-eared to wider culture?
I think the church has probably kind of allowed itself. We were just talking earlier about how of the whatever it is, 120 Anglican bishops, only one voted for Brexit, and I think this sort of switch that has happened within the Anglican Church, certainly between being the Conservative Party at prayer to now being the kind of ultra-liberal party at prayer, has not been to the church's long-term benefit, I don't think. I mean, I'm not saying it should go back to what it was, but I think the church ought to be in a stronger position than it is today, you know, given these value divides that I've written about in my book and that were manifested by the Brexit vote. We saw it in the Trump vote in America and so on, these gulfs between the kind of highly educated, mobile people, usually graduates, you know, with the general kind of agnostic worldview in favor of openness and autonomy and self-realization and all of that, and still the more small C conservative, settled worldview, place more stress on security and familiarity, tends to draw value from group attachments and tends to be more patriotic and so on than the more educated mobile groups. I mean, these new divisions that have emerged ought in a way to, I mean, you know, the church ought to be in the right position to sort of act as a bridge, because it is the task of politics, I think, or and anyone who's involved in society, to think of ways of how one overcomes these divisions. And you know, it is the task of politics to bring together conflicting interests or find common ground between conflicting interest groups. I think the church, by becoming so associated with or many of the most liberal currents in our society, very much associated with the kind of mobile educated groups, the church has not been there really. This is a moment where, I mean, I'm not quite sure what sort of decisions it should have taken 10, 15, 20 years ago to be there. But whenever I do hear a bishop or even an archbishop speaking, I think they are speaking to such a narrow group of people. I don't even mean believers. I think just in their worldview, they are such a long way from, you know, the dwindling remnants of their own believing group too. I don't know enough about it to have any coherent advice, but you know, the church could and perhaps could yet still play a role as a kind of a sort of national therapist almost. That I don't really see it playing today. And although, you know, it uses that rhetoric often, and there's a sort of and obviously the church is always almost too excessively talking about bringing groups together, and that just sounds pious. I mean, you've got to acknowledge differences and conflicts, genuine conflicts. Yeah. And you've got to be ready to speak up for your own side. I mean, there is a lot that's really rather good in the Christian faith. Dare one say it, possibly even better than some other faiths. But would you ever hear a man or woman of the cloth saying that? No, of course you wouldn't. But, you know, is it Leviticus, the golden rule? I mean, you know, this is the kind of foundation of modern liberalism in some ways, isn't it?
We're going to take a short break now to catch up with what is going on with the Theos team. I am here in the Theos office with my colleague Nathan Mladen. Nathan is a researcher and head of relationships here and working on various projects, including one about debt. But today I wanted to hear a bit about his PhD. Nathan has submitted it recently as amounts to his Viva, and should, as I'm sure he pass, he will quickly become one of the most qualified members of the team. Nathan, I'd love to hear what you've been pouring your heart and soul into for the last 5 years before you joined us.
Well, I never get tired of saying that it's been a long journey. A long, long journey, but you know, it's coming to an end now, and I'm really looking forward to next week, although I'm obviously quite terrified.
Nathan, what's the title of your PhD?
Theatre in Providence, the Strengths and Limitations of a Theatrical Model for Theology.
So you're a theatre geek. You love going to see plays.
I do, although I haven't really been to the theatre very much in the last few months because I've been writing this piece of work called a PhD thesis. But yes, I do like theatre.
And one of my previous guests on the podcast, Pippa Evans, calls herself an improviser. What she does is showstoppers and various other things. You know, improvisation is her religion. I gather you've been thinking a bit about improvisation as well.
Yes, actually, yes. Improvisation is a pretty big deal in the thesis, because what the thesis really tries to do is kind of show theatre as a particularly useful model for thinking about a very simple but actually a pretty complicated question about how God relates and interacts with the world. So it's kind of sitting in this now growing stream of work at the intersection between theology and the arts, and theology and theatre more specifically, and tries to say, what's God got to do with it, and what does theatre have to do with this question?
So what the images that it's bringing up for me is that, well, originally God is a kind of jazz improviser with a black beret and a smoky bar, but I'm assuming that's just me. Is it about God's, how much is predetermined, that actually there's not a plan that he's just crunching through, but he is improvising in relationship with us?
Yes. In fact, I do come out saying that I think it's helpful, obviously with qualifications, to think of God as an improviser. And I think, you know, the takeaway point from that is that whatever the world throws at him, whatever we throw at him, whatever things we say and do that really kind of mess things up, God is always the infinitely excellent improviser who will always say yes and to the world and to our screw-ups.
So this is the second time yes and has been mentioned on this podcast. It's something I've been learning from Pippa, that actually when good improvisation is about not blocking, but letting things flow through you by saying yes and building on things. And I'm hoping that Pippa's going to finish her book soon about improv your life, because it feels like a pretty good philosophy.
That sounds excellent. Yes, absolutely. Yes and is at the core of improvisation. So, you know, my thesis basically says, how far will the theatrical model, which is all, you know, all of these images and all these pictures hanging together somehow, how far can they take us in thinking about this thorny question of how God relates to the world? What's God got to do with my waking up this morning? What's God got to do with Trump and Brexit, to use these overused words for 2017?
Well, we hope to create some space for Nathan to do some more work on theology and the arts. He's not the only one in the team with an interest in this. I did a master's in Christianity and the arts many moons ago, and our colleague Anna Wheeler, who I'm sure we'll speak to on a future podcast, also has an interest. So keep your ears tuned for it. And if it's something that you're interested in, please do get in touch with Nathan via our website. To come on to one of the themes in your most recent book, The Road to Somewhere, about, and you've alluded really to these two groups, which you really helpfully call the somewheres, people who feel rooted to place, essentially, and the anywheres, who think of themselves as more mobile, global citizens. And they map quite helpfully, well, quite roughly, but helpfully, onto the way people voted around Brexit. This podcast is particularly interested in how we talk to people who disagree with us, people who have different values from us, see the world differently. How do you think the somewheres and the anywheres are doing at talking to each other?
Well, obviously not at all well. I mean, just one sort of minor caveat to what you said. I mean, I this anywhere group that I described, I mentioned earlier, I mean, the mobile and the educated essentially are a very large group. It isn't just the metropolitan, liberal metropolitan elites or the, you know, the kind of global villagers. They are a subset of anywheres. I mean, anywheres are 20, 25% of the population and growing quite fast. So, you know, a very large proportion of the people that you will see, you know, on the streets of London will be anywheres. I mean, we're not talking about a small group, but this gulf is particularly acute, I think, in this country, partly because, well, for various reasons. I mean, even compared to, say, the United States or continental Europe, I think it was very clear after the Brexit referendum that huge swathes of the country that had voted Remain knew nobody in their friendship circle or family who'd voted Brexit, and vice versa. And I think that's partly because of our tradition. It's actually not a very long tradition. It's really since the Robbins Report of overwhelmingly residential universities that we have developed a system of mass higher education which mimics the forms of old elite Oxford and Cambridge higher education. And I think that has had some rather damaging consequences in a way that so many of the people, you know, the affluent, the managerial classes, the people in positions of authority in Britain, whatever social class background they come from, overwhelmingly are people that have left home at 18 to go to a residential university. They probably then, if they're ambitious and they're pursuing professional careers, they will have gone off to live in a metropolitan centre, London, quite possibly, may have gone abroad to work for a year or two.
Something in education is deliberately derouting people. Well,
exactly. I mean, very deliberately. And they will have networks, friendship networks, that are completely different to the ones they had when they were at school. I mean, even in America, that's not true. I mean, half of American students live at home, so you have a more kind of evolutionary process. So your high school friends and your college friends will often sort of be in the same networks. So even if you're quite a successful person in America, and I think in perhaps in Germany too, you will still have contact with the, you know, ordinary people, to use the ugly phrase. And I think that's been much less the case here. I mean, when I go around talking about my book, I often say to people, you know, if they've put up your hands, if you're a graduate, if you went to university, particularly if you went to a good Russell Group university, and keep your hand up if you have any close friends who are non-graduates. And most people put their hands down. And I think that has helped to make these distinctions sharper here. Having said that, I mean, I do think, although my book is partly about these value gulfs and divisions, I think there is a danger of exaggerating it. And I think it is worth pointing out that there is actually a very high level of consensus about some pretty fundamental things in British society. Pretty well everybody in Britain sort of signs up to the idea of a highly regulated market economy, attached to or alongside what is, by historical standards, a very big state. There's some political difference between left and right on the size of the state, but actually not a huge amount. It's kind of 38 versus 42%, possibly slightly more with a Corbyn Labour government, but not a huge amount more. And we have a public space that is pretty permissive, pretty egalitarian, pretty liberal. And again, most people sign up to that. Most people sign up to this combination of what, you know, it's sort of crude, sort of and somewhat economistic description of British society. But, it's worth remembering that when we talk about the value divisions, and these value divisions are, I think, much more socio-cultural than they are socio-economic.
So where are the flashpoints, do you think? Where are the real value gaps that are, you know, I might call them sacred values, but for you, value gaps that are causing people to feel like the other is more of a stranger than perhaps they necessarily are?
Well, I mean, I think it is encapsulated by this anywhere somewhere distinction, and particularly the feeling that somewheres have that it's like the sort of centrifugal versus centripetal, isn't it? I mean, that somewheres feel that they are the centripetal force in society, and the leavers, the people that that not only leave but also
not leave as in Brexit, but leave the place of origin.
Yeah, exactly. The leavers tended to be Remainers, and Remainers leavers, as it were. But that they've moved into a much more individualistic sphere. They don't hold any of the things that somewheres hold sacred, to use the term we talked about at the start. And indeed, they often have contempt for the group attachments, the attachments to tradition, the belief in security, in familiarity. The importance of familiarity to most people is seen by not all, but I think by some anywheres, as something rather juvenile, possibly even contemptible. And this Roger Scruton has this Greek concept for it. I don't know if you've read his work on this. He calls it oikophobia, meaning kind of phobia of place or the rooted. And it is, I think it is a sort of factor, something in, I don't know if it's just modern Western culture or whether it's becoming better educated anywhere in the world, in any culture, that there's somehow what goes along with that often is a sort of repudiation of roots and place and a feeling that that rootlessness and transcendence and you know, internationalism, cosmopolitanism is not only something that's sort of interesting and good, but is better than rootedness. I mean, I think this is one of the problems, is the, I don't think, you know, most somewheres perfectly happy for people to be internationally minded. They're probably quite internationally minded themselves in a vague sort of way. You know, they like to go abroad, and they will make donations to international charities, and they obviously believe that countries should cooperate for peace and the environment and things like that. Very few people are sort of, you know, really old-fashioned protectionist nationalists that want nothing to do with abroad any longer. I mean, tiny proportion of the population. But I think they probably view with suspicion that part of the population, which is still small but probably growing quite fast, which is genuinely cosmopolitan, doesn't really feel any attachment to this country, and what is, I think, what gets people, what creates hostility, is the idea that that is morally superior. And actually, I mean, perhaps this is just a bit of sophistry in a way, but it always reminds me of the paradox of cosmopolitanism. Of course, is that cosmopolitanism requires a critical mass of somewheres. It requires countries. It requires indigenous populations and cultures, because the whole point of cosmopolitanism is one sort of flits from one place to another place. But if there aren't those places, so if everybody was a cosmopolitan, cosmopolitanism would be impossible.
Yes.
Cosmopolitanism requires rootedness, and yet it often sees itself as somehow superior to the rooted, and people who have a stronger attachment to the people and the places they know well than they do to people on the other side of the world. And that, you know, there's an aspect of modern liberalism that has denigrated that, and that, I mean, it's one can sort of see its roots in the moral universalism of Christianity. Indeed, many of the great world religions have an aspect of moral universalism, as indeed have some of the great millenarian political movements of the past. But actually, in the 20th century, partly as a result of the horrors of the first part of the 20th century, two world wars, decolonization, a Holocaust, there was a kind of element of moral universalism came to be written into our into the UN 1948 declaration, and indeed into the constitutions of most liberal societies. But a belief in the moral equality of all human beings is not the same as saying we have the same obligation to all human beings. I think there's a sort of category error that many liberals made and perhaps still make. Because that, I mean, a kind of full universalism like that makes absolutely no sense at all. I mean, I think it's a kind of unhuman thing, and it has within it the kind of destruction of any coherent society. We cannot have the same, I mean, not everybody can be my brother. If everybody is my brother, then nobody is my brother, essentially.
What's interesting is there is a definite thread in the New Testament, I think. There is a definite political theology that you can read from Jesus. It's not the only one. That points us in that direction. That says, you know, any fool can love someone who loves you. It says to his mother and brother, you know, these are not my family. My family is my disciples. There is lots of people have seen that trajectory in liberalism towards a moral universalism that says the kind of good human being moves from loyalty to immediate family to loyalty to immediate clan or tribe to loyalty and obligation to wider human society. And I think I think
it does need to be bounded. I mean, it doesn't work if it's completely unbounded. You know, the Good Samaritan actually shared a society with the man he helped.
But in acknowledging our boundaries, I know that a lot of liberals would feel nervous about with your argument would be the permission that gives for tribalism, the permission that gives to say, you know, your the people that you are connected to, you can fight for their rights and sort everyone else. Do you think that that's just a false illusion?
Yes, I do. I mean, and I think, you know, you need to be kind of hard on an unthinking universalism. You need to be just as hard on an unthinking tribalism as on an unthinking universalism. Neither of them work in big, complex modern societies. But some, you know, I mean, the idea that there are obligations, kind of, we have obligations in an abstract way to every other human being. But I think those obligations necessarily become weaker in some ways the sort of further away people are. And I think having a strong attachment to one's own place, one's own family, one's own town, one's own society, is perfectly compatible with being generous and open towards the rest of the world. You know, charity begins at home, but it doesn't end at home, I think is the best way of putting it.
And do you think that this is the reason that immigration as a policy, which, you know, on one hand could be quite a dry, wonky, what's going on with our borders and the movement of units of people and resources, and actually is a deeply emotive, really probably the most emotive flashpoint in our politics at the moment, is this clash of the values of the somewheres and the values of the anywheres?
Yes, I mean, I think immigration is an issue that is both an issue in itself, in its own right, but also it's a kind of emblem issue. It's emblematic of rapid social change. It's an emblem of the disregard that what is seen by many people on less well-educated, more modest incomes, that the more rooted somewhere type people, it's seen as an emblem of the relative disregard that liberally minded elites and political classes have for them. It's as if they're saying these other people are more important. That they used to worry about us, you know, the liberally minded, the kind of Polly Toynbee classes, they used to care about, you know, the ordinary poor people of Britain. And now
it's almost like adoptive, you know, parents who adopt another child and the first child feels abandoned.
Well, yeah, or the who's the character in Bleak House? Mrs. somebody or other, you know, who cares not for her own children, but is sort of caring about all those causes the other side of the world. You know, all of those, you know, all of the kind of, you know, DFID is the most popular Whitehall department by a long way amongst highly educated kids coming out of elite universities. That sense that they're not particularly interested in visiting the lonely granny around the corner, you know, for an hour at the weekend. They're much more interested in, you know, it's the sort of saviour complex of the kind of liberal managerial classes, if you like. They want to save the world, but not actually, you know, they want to do it on a grander scale than the little everyday actions that could actually improve the world just as much.
Speaking of tribes and commitments and groups, you've had an interesting journey in yourself. You talk about having moved from a broadly liberal political position to a much smaller C conservative, and having seen that happen politically. I'd love to hear how that's been for you personally and emotionally, in the sense of your loyalties. You wrote, I think in 2004, you began to write about immigration in a way that went against the current liberal consensus. What was the reaction like then, and what was going on in you internally as you were coming to those conclusions?
It was, it's a story that tends to get recycled, not always by me, but every time I write a book or something. It's a sort of peg that people like. This has been said about me for at least 10 years. I first sort of stumbled into these debates about race and immigration and multiculturalism and so on back in 2004, when I wrote an essay in Prospect magazine called Too Diverse? ? About the tension, very much directed, an essay very much directed at the centre left, and looking at the tension between solidarity and diversity, suggesting this is something that people on the left needed to think about. That these two things are not necessarily in conflict, but there is some inherent tension that could perhaps be mitigated, but you need to give thought to it. Perhaps you need to worry about more modest levels of immigration. You need to think about integrating people in so that the we is expanded, so that people are happy to share their resources. So it's based on the common sense premise that people are happier to share with people they feel they have things in common with and trust. And
were you changing your mind at that stage?
I think I sort of came to it, in almost through argument. Through intellectual debate. I hadn't, when I wrote the piece, it seemed to me a sort of relatively commonsensical argument from within contemporary liberalism, saying, exploring some of the potential tensions and contradictions. It was reprinted in The Guardian and caused quite a hullabaloo, and I was accused of being a nice racist, I think, and various other terms like that. Up to a point, but it sort of seemed to me so untrue and sort of silly in a way. I don't remember feeling. I started going I got invited to events, and there would be, people would sort of shout at me, and I became a bit of a bad guy, and. I got into some emotional arguments with people, but I sort of felt that this was this is kind of the new front line of politics in some ways. It's kind of left and right was in some ways receding in importance, these kinds of conflicts over national identity and how more diverse and liberal societies kind of hold together. What are the common norms that we require in order to function well as a modern society? That these were the new centre ground of politics. And I pursued that interest. I didn't always want to. I was interested in other things too. The problem is it's very easy to get sort of typecast. He's the sort of ex-lefty who's prepared to say things about immigration and multiculturalism and it was around the time when the BBC was starting to become a little bit more aware of the kind of narrowness of its own perspective. So I was quite useful in that I was still sort of an acceptably liberal person, but said things that were, I think, felt and believed by large parts of the population.
I think I booked you when I was working on The Moral Maze in that exact box.
So have I kind of lost friends and had, arguments at dinner parties? Yeah. But I think it's the thing that Jonathan Haidt writes about, and one doesn't want to sound smug about it, but if you kind of, you've not only do you understand liberalism, you've been inside liberalism, but you feel that you're then able to kind of look at it somewhat more objectively, at least half from the outside, you're in some ways in a stronger position, as he says in The Righteous Mind. I mean, conservatives or non-liberals can, you know, recognize whatever it is, sort of five or six political impulses, don't they? You know, there's the basic liberal ones of fairness and harm. I mean, kind of reduction of harm, the kind of utilitarian reduction of harm, fairness and justice. But then there's also the sacred,
loyalty,
tradition. Well, I think that's the sacred.
Yeah, sacred and tradition, that's right.
And I feel I can, yeah, well, I have read it, yeah. I sort of straddle the divide. I think I can see and feel. I mean, this is partly about feeling, because hardly anybody really comes to positions. I'm slightly contradicting myself because I'm suggesting I did over raising question marks about multiculturalism, but I mean, invariably we adopt positions that are based on our pre-existing values and feelings and priorities. And educated people are better at selecting the data and the information to support their case. But they are. This is the point, in a way, that Michael Gove, I think, was making in his sort of critique of experts, that actually experts and ordinary people have exactly the same impulse when it comes to taking up positions. Experts do not, I mean, except in sort of narrowly technical areas, obviously the real experts, the people who keep the planes flying and the computers working and remove the tumour from our brain or whatever. I mean, those are the real experts. We leave them aside. But the kind of experts who take part in political debate have come to their views in exactly the same way that ordinary people have. They're no more likely to sort of survey the evidence on an issue and then come objectively to a certain set of views than Joe Bloggs is. And Joe Bloggs knows that. And it's one of the reasons why I think, you know, that the claim to expertise often, well, it needs to acknowledge that fact.
Does knowing that make you more humble when you're engaging in public? Or is that just not possible within the current terms of our public debate to caveat yourself, to say, I'm not sure, or I've changed my mind?
Yeah, I mean, I try to say that as often as I can. I mean, if I'm on doing something on the radio or TV. But yeah, you're right, though. It's often and indeed it's part of the sort of centrifugal tendencies in modern societies is that we do often, this is probably not so true of political media. Political media has always been adversarial because that's our political tradition in a way. But you find yourself, I do often find myself wanting to be somewhat more rounded and accommodating, and you find yourself in these kind of more gladiatorial situations the whole time. Because you do believe what you believe and you want to defend it, and you end up, in a kind of verbal punch-up. I don't want to sound pious about it. I mean, I think that's often how it should be too. I mean, but I do think it's, a parenthetical thought. I mean, I think again, Jonathan Haidt has talked about this, I think, in an interesting way, this sort of centrifugal versus centripetal effect in our society. And so many of the sort of centripetal forces have loosened or been in decline. I mean, just at the very basic level, I mean, not so long ago, we all lived under the threat of the Cold War. I mean, that held us together as a country, held us together as a kind of Western alliance, held us together in Europe in all sorts of ways, held us together with America. That has disappeared. Obviously, it's good that it has, but it sort of relaxes one of the muscles of combination. And the media, I think, is another very good example. I mean, when I was young, large parts, we had, three, four channels on the TV. Everybody in the society, from the richest he to the poorest, watched the same, 25 million of us or whatever it was, watched the Morecambe and Wise show at Christmas. And there was a sense of the kind of media as the kind of national campfire around which we sat. And now, of course, it hasn't gone completely, but it's not nearly as strong as it was. And of course, we've got the social media with the you know, the confirmation bias bubbles and all of that. And you've got a much more liberal and a much more diverse society. You've got the rise of identity politics. You've got that much higher levels of immigration that have all add to that reduction in trust and sort of and centripetalism, if you like.
Obviously, in 2004, after that piece, and for the years following, Twitter was not yet a big thing. And we've seen just this week as we're recording, Toby Young resign after, you know, public outcry after his appointment to the Office for Students. Do you think that had your developing thinking on immigration been happening, you know, in 2004 and Twitter had been around, you might have had quite a different experience?
That's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of it. I suspect I would have done. I mean, I might have felt a lot more battered than I mean, just thinking about it, because you were asking about it earlier. I mean, I was trying to think back, and I remember feeling, you know, a bit under siege sometimes, but I felt confident enough in my own case, in my own skin. I didn't think I was a racist in any kind of meaningful sense. I mean, in beyond the sense that we are all, you know, you have the Harvard test or whatever it is, you know, we all respond racially at some unconscious level. But I was confident that that what I was saying was reasonable indeed, that it was something that the vast majority of the population believed. But you're right. If I had said it now, I think I'd have had a much more uncomfortable experience. Because this was a time, 2004, you know, it's not that long ago, but it was still certainly on the left, you know, most broadly defined, you know, saying that levels of immigration are too high or far too high, despite the fact that 70% of the population or whatever told pollsters that pretty well every week, it was still quite a strong taboo. And that was very unhealthy for our public debate. I mean, you know, that is certainly very, very different today. And I think we have learnt sort of gradually to separate out issues of the economic and indeed cultural impact of large-scale immigration from issues of racial justice, which you know, possibly overlap in some ways, but are essentially completely different subjects. I mean, perhaps that was helped by the fact that so much of the immigration since 2004 was white European. Yeah. I think it's a good point. I think it would have been much more uncomfortable doing that today.
You are on Twitter, I believe.
Yeah.
And how do you find engaging with people who disagree with you or attack you? Do you just block them, or do you?
No, I've blocked hardly. The only people I block are people who seem to be doing commercial things. You know, you suddenly get a whole stream of tweets selling you something. I mean, I've only blocked a couple of people in my life, partly because I haven't worked out how to do it. But I mean, there are plenty of people on, you know, who follow me, whose views I do not like at all. But and occasionally I will have a brief exchange with them. But I try to. I think it's a sort of good thing in a way to have as broad a spectrum of people in your, what's it called, your feed, your as possible. I mean, I sort of almost pride myself on that, because that's what I was trying to do. I mean, it's at Prospect when I was in the last few years when I was editing Prospect, you know, try and have the argument, you know, within the pages of one magazine rather than be the New Statesman or the Spectator with your, but to be, you know, have left and right, open, closed, you know, anywhere, somewheres, whatever, arguing with each other in a civilized way, and being a platform for that, you know, open to all kind of intelligent and well-expressed shades of opinion, and that is something I still very much believe in, and partly what my book although I'm very critical of Anywheres, I mean, I'm an Anywhere myself, and it's, the book is very much directed at Anywheres. It's both of these worldviews are completely, perhaps this is something I didn't emphasise enough or haven't emphasised enough, because a lot of people have sort of felt rather offended by my book, particularly at the sort of Guardian end of the spectrum, and, you know, associated me with the famous Theresa May point about if you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. It's a statement I completely agree with, although I think it's turned out to be very counterproductive for her. It's been her sort of basket of deplorables, probably cost her a few seats actually at the last election. I've wanted to try and acknowledge that both of these worldviews are completely legitimate. there is a political problem in that one has been overly dominant in our politics and culture in recent times, and some adjustment is necessary. We don't want to replace one form of dominance by another. We don't want all the kind of anywhere values to be out the window and somewhereism to be sort of arrogantly replacing it on the throne. I do think it's interesting, in the post-Brexit politics has sort of followed this pattern a little bit, that what's happened is you've seen a sort of distinction within the anywhere political class between the sort of militants, the kind of AC Greylings, the people who say, you know, these Brexit people are barbarians, you know, we must sort of hold the line against them. And then the kind of admonished anywheres, both amongst the ordinary voters and the political class, of whom perhaps Theresa May is the prime example, of people who say, oh, actually, we got this wrong, didn't we? I mean, look, I mean, we haven't been listening to people, and we've now had this kind of revolution in the form of the Brexit vote. You know, if we want to restabilize our politics, then we have to find a new settlement. I mean, that's what politics is. It is about finding agreement between conflicting interest groups. And we seem to have kind of lost that sense that is what political statecraft is. I was just at a seminar listening to Nick Bowles talking a couple of days ago, and there were people mainly from the centre-right there, but everything they said, it occurred to me, could have been agreed with. And much of it was sort of technical stuff about how to increase investment levels, how to solve the housing crisis, what to do about sort of social care and things. A huge spectrum of political opinion, including the Corbynites in some cases. We know we were talking, Nick Bowles was talking about ways of reducing the excesses of directors' pay by making the next round of corporate tax cuts dependent on companies showing some modesty in the ratio between their highest paid member of staff and the average, and ideas like that, which would probably appeal to the court. And it occurred to me, we actually have still quite a high level of consensus, particularly on these more socioeconomic issues. But what we lack is the sort of state that is the consensus building, the statecraft to create political solutions. Now, that may well be because, although our politics in an abstract way, I think, is in a perfectly healthy state, you know, you might say the Brexit vote was a sign of democratic vitality and health in some ways. And look, compare Scotland to Catalonia. I mean, this is a real vote of confidence in all the smart people for the last 30 years. The Anthony Barnetts have been going around saying, God, aren't we antediluvian? You know, we don't have a written constitution. Well, thank God we don't. You know, that it turns out that the kind of bottom-up common law, parliamentary sovereignty tradition, when something like Scotland comes along, for all sorts of contingent reasons, historical reasons, Scotland gets politically dominated by the SNP. There's a big move towards independence. London is able to say, well, we don't want you to go, but okay, have a referendum. And it went what I think is the right way, relatively close, but went the right way. And look at Catalonia. Spain has a written constitution with some rather silly things written in it, i.e. Catalonia cannot have a referendum. So you're left in this kind of terrible mess. Yeah. There's a flexibility about our system. And I mean, I think, you know, this is, although I voted Remain, I was pretty 50-50, and I'm not unhappy about Brexit. And I think this illustrates some of our great historic political strengths in a way that are threatened by European different European political norms.
Can I? It's okay. Can you? I'm going to ask one final question. As someone who I think is clearly actually quite good at communicating across difference and quite comfortable with difference and moving between different tribes, what would be the one thing that you think would make our public conversations better, that would help us in reconnecting some of these groups?
Yes. How does one? I mean, it sort of comes down to emotional intelligence in a way, doesn't it? I think statecraft is a kind of big macro form of emotional intelligence in some way. I mean, if we're trying to bring different interest groups together, you know, if we're talking about rebooting Britain after Brexit, like I said, there's a huge number of things that we can all agree on, that or a very large proportion of the population can agree on. Our problem at the moment is that while our underlying politics, as I just described, I think is quite healthy, our party system is out of sync in a way. It hasn't, on the historic left-right divisions, even though it's drifted away from those in the sense that, you know, the Labour Party has become largely the party of the liberal middle class. Tory Party is now a more working class party, at least in its voter base, than Labour. So all of that's become confused. The parties are both divided by the new value divisions, the kind of anywhere somewhere type divisions, albeit in Labour's case more between its MPs and activists and its voters. So we're in a political mess because the parties don't reflect the new divisions. On the other, having said that, I mean, I don't think it would necessarily be a good idea for new parties to emerge, as it were, to reflect in purer form the new value divide, say. That actually there's something very healthy about the fact that parties are always coalitions of conflicting groups, because the whole of society is a coalition of conflicting groups in some way. So you get, you know, you learn your political statecraft in the inner party context before taking it out to the national context. And I think we're going through a period when we seem to be particularly weak at that. I mean, the classic example here is the Conservative Party manifesto, where a actually quite bold and maybe sensible approach to sharing the burden of the social care bill by drawing down some of the equity gains made by, generally speaking, more affluent people in London and the South East in order to pay for social care. No work seems to have gone into preparing the ground for this. So the whole thing blew up in the middle of an election campaign, partly contributing to the Conservatives' very poor performance, partly in the way that it revealed Theresa May's woodenness politically. But I think we need to keep parties as coalitions of different groups, and for the reasons you were saying, anyway, in order to learn how to talk across these gulfs and divisions and learn how to be emotionally intelligent in political argument.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I really hope you enjoyed it, and I do hope that you're listening to our previous episodes. Do follow us on Twitter @sacred_podcast. You can tell me directly what you thought @TheosElizabeth, and you can find out more about our work at Theos at theosthinktank.co.uk.